From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The baby boomer generation is faced with difficult decisions when it comes to caring for aging parents. In our first half hour today, Ingrid Wenzel of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging, based in Cedar Rapids, will tell us about the costs and the benefits of options, home health care, assisted living, and nursing homes. Then, in the second half hour, world-renowned literary journalist Gail Sheehy joins us to discuss her new book on the topic, Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. It all starts right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on our program, we examine the challenges that lie ahead for the baby boomer generation when it comes to care for aging parents. What are the best options when it comes to long-term care? A nursing home, assisted living, or home care? What about the costs associated with each? Later in the hour, a conversation with renowned author Gail Sheehy. Her new book, Passages in Caregiving, examines her role as a caregiver after her husband was diagnosed with cancer. But first, a conversation with Ingrid Wenzel. Wenzel is the assistant director of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging, based in Cedar Rapids. Heritage is one of 600 agencies across the country and one of 13 across Iowa addressing the needs of the elderly. Wenzel just returned from Washington, D.C., where she investigated the ramifications of the health care overhaul for seniors and what changes lie on the horizon. Ingrid Wenzel, a lot of people have not heard of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging. Who are you? What do you do?
Well, we're the best-kept secret. We're delighted that we've provided services for 35 years by helping to fund, plan, and coordinate home and community-based services for older adults. That includes such things as home-delivered meals, respite services, adult daycare services, chore and transportation services.
Any political affiliations?
Absolutely none. We are a nonpartisan advocacy organization for older adults.
And you're funded by?
We are funded by the Older Americans Act, limited state resources and private contributions, and the Medicaid program.
Now, I understand you recently returned from Washington, D.C., investigating ramifications of the health care overhaul for seniors. What did you find out in your investigation going to Washington, D.C.?
First, I think, would be to clarify that there is going to be no reduction of benefits for individuals receiving supports under Medicare. We've been getting some calls from folks saying, I'm worried my Medicare benefits will be cut. You are guaranteed benefits under Medicare, and those benefits are guaranteed in the law that has been passed.
When those people call, what is the source of their worries? Where are they getting the information that would lead them to believe there would be Medicare cuts?
Well, unfortunately, people talk around the dinner table and talk amongst their friends and colleagues, and rumors start, particularly when there is a piece of legislation that is so far-reaching and the devil is in the details, and we are to that point. We learned a lot that right now the implementation of the health care reform is really going to be falling to the states. And that is a bit concerning, particularly since our service structure is already very pressed as it is, let alone if we're looking at implementing over a period of several years in a very compressed time frame an overhaul to this magnitude.
Mm-hmm. When it's falling to the state, so who in the state will be most concerned? Whose shoulders will this implementation fall upon?
Well, the service delivery system as it exists right now through our Department of Human Services, who manages and provides support for the Medicaid program, is going to be responsible for implementing many of the new programs associated with the health care reform. Right now, the Department of Human Services, because of budget cutbacks, are looking at a huge loss in their workforce. They are already pressed to serve the clients that they are serving now, let alone needing to understand and process and move forward administrative rules associated with the health care reform legislation.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that for those who are guaranteed Medicare benefits, there's no change, there's no reduction, there are no cuts?
Yes, that is correct. There is some changes that may be happening to what's called the MA or the Medicare Advantage plans. You may have heard some folks express concerns about this. Right now in Iowa, about 67,000 Iowans rely on the Medicare Advantage plans, which is sometimes called Medicare Part C. These plans are purchased privately. And one of the ways the government is looking at paying for the health care overhaul is reducing the payments it makes to providers via the Medicare Advantage plans. Mm-hmm. Right now, the federal government pays between 14% and 17% more for Medicare Advantage enrollees than they do for those who are enrolled in traditional Medicare programs. And they're looking at tightening up that service they provide, the payments they provide for those providers. However, there are some guarantees for individuals who are currently receiving benefits under Medicare Advantage. Now the law requires that providers do spend 85 cents on every dollar on services for Medicare beneficiaries. They also require that MA plans cannot change their service menu to go below what the guaranteed Medicare benefits are under traditional Medicare.
So if cuts are being made to what MA, Medicare Advantage, and the people who receive Medicare are not getting any cuts, who are receiving the cuts? Where are these monies going?
Well, there are no cuts per se. What they're looking at is slowing the growth associated with health care. Right now, the costs of the Medicare program has expanded a great deal over the last 20 years. Annually, it's grown about 8% a year for the last 20 years. It is hoped that this law can slow the annual increase in spending to about 6% over the next 20 years by implementing some cost-saving measures. I just indicated one, slowing the growth of payments to those Medicare Advantage providers. The second is focusing on fraud and abuse associated with payments within the program. The other thing is they're looking at slowing the rate to providers. And this is by and large been not universally accepted, but accepted by the provider network. They're not talking about reducing payments to physicians, however. There's actually some incentives for physicians to provide expanded services to what we expect will be Medicare enrollees who are either changing from Medicare Advantage plans to traditional Medicare or new Medicare beneficiaries as they enter into the system, as they age into the system.
Mm. It's all very complex, and we'll find out more as time goes by. But if someone's listening, receiving Medicare right now, what's the best thing that person can do to find out about their particular coverage?
Well, first and foremost, again, there should not be any cuts in services for individuals under the Medicare program, traditional Medicare program. Actually, those services will be expanded in some cases. The first is there's going to be a free annual wellness visit, and there's going to no longer be any out-of-pocket costs for preventative benefits such as cancer and diabetes screening. There's also going to be better coordination of care for individuals who are suffering from chronic diseases. Also, the annual enrollment period, which has been a source of frustration for some folks, mm-hmm. is actually going to be expanded now. It's now going to run through October 15th through December 7th. Some of the things that they can do as far as getting information, if they feel comfortable getting on the web, they can go to Medicare.gov, and there's exceptional information there. They can also contact SHIP, which is the Senior Health Insurance Information Program in Iowa, and they can also provide information to Medicare beneficiaries. You know, a good bit of news this year is that folks who do fall into what's called the donut hole, individuals who are receiving benefits under Medicare Part D, which is a prescription drug benefit, will actually receive a $250 rebate this first year. Over the next 10 years, this program, the law rather, is looking to close the gap in the donut hole for individuals receiving prescription drug benefits.
We hear a lot about this donut hole problem. So for those not acquainted with it, what exactly is the donut hole?
Right now, Medicare provides a prescription drug benefit. People call it Medicare Part D. And in Medicare Part D, it provides supports for prescription drugs up to a certain amount. And then that coverage stops between this donut hole the individuals are actually responsible for paying their prescription drug costs until they get beyond that donut hole, which is several thousands of dollars. It can be quite a burden for individuals, and unfortunately, there are Medicare beneficiaries who are having to make very difficult decisions about, you know, are they going to be actually purchasing their medication, or are they going to be purchasing food, or are they going to be, you know, ensure safe housing? So it's a serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the long, what we can call maybe healthy, vigorous health care reform debate, some might say rancorous debate that we had prior to this bill being signed into law, there were a lot of things said, and polls reflect now that some people are not so sure about this health care overhaul. President Obama predicts that the overhaul will become more popular as people feel its effects. What are your feelings when you look at this in light of your investigation in Washington, D.C.?
Well, my feelings are that the advocacy really has just begun. It's going to be several years before we get a real clear picture of how the reform is going to be implemented. Advocacy is going to be needed at a state level, working with state departments, working with insurance regulators, working with individuals in the healthcare profession who actually are going to be moving this forward, and talking with them about what is working and what is not working. So my response is simply that is yet to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Things are moving forward very, very quickly. There's an immense amount of pressure at the federal level to be able to move forward direction to the states to start their process for implementation. And there's already concerns it is moving very, very quickly. And how that can be done and how that will be done, and I'll speak directly to Iowa, within this compressed time frame with the reduction in staffing, it will be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. So when you put on your skeptic's hat with the expertise that you have here, you see that the potential snags would be in the state implementation of these federal mandates?
Oh, I think absolutely there's going to be some bumps in the road. I mean, this is a very, very far-reaching, comprehensive relook at how we are actually delivering health care reform, and it would be foolish to say that there would not be some bumps in the road.
Can you name any of the bumps at this point?
Well, I mean, to be very blunt about it, I think I said this earlier, is that we have our staff at the Department of Human Services is very compressed as it is. And if they are being put in the position of having to figure out how to actually implement this program, it's going to be very, very challenging for them. The time frames also are very, very compressed. Many of the changes the healthcare reform package would like to move forward would traditionally take 2 to 4 years are now hoping to get accomplished in 1 or 2 years, and really just do not fall in with the state structure and moving administrative rules and processes forward.
After a short break, more of my conversation with Ingrid Wenzel of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's get back to my conversation with Ingrid Wenzel, the Assistant Director of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging in Cedar Rapids. Her organization coordinates and funds a number of services addressing the needs of the elderly. Ingrid, I'd like to turn to a report that was just issued. Seniors hoping to stay in their homes with assistance will find higher costs in Iowa compared to costs nationwide, according to this report. An exception being Cedar Rapids. This is according to a new report by Genworth Financial, which released its annual cost of care survey in April.
Well, my response is actually services in the home are still a bargain compared to services to received in institutional-based settings such as nursing home care. The report that I also read, and they based those numbers, the hourly rate, and when they costed it out as as much as it would cost for a year of service. They base that on 44 hours of support. It's very unusual for an individual to receive 44 hours of home health care services in the home over a continued basis. Typically, an individual who receives home health care will receive 2 or 3 hours a day to help with basic functions of daily living, such as bathing and dressing. 44 hours a day is very, very unusual. So although it seems that
a week.
So although $19 an hour seems, boy, that's pretty pricey, if you look at the true cost of supporting an individual at home versus living in an institutional-based setting, it really is still quite a bargain for supports.
This home care, I see that the Des Moines area came in higher than the national average, $23 per hour for this home care.
Mm-hmm.
Cedar Rapids actually below the national rate, $18 per hour.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at that range in Iowa, how does that compare with other types of care in assisted living outside of the home?
Right now, the costs vary quite dramatically for individuals who are receiving care in certain different environments. And one is most people understand the nursing home care. Nursing home care is an environment that for individuals typically who have a variety of needs and also would provide different level of care, including skilled care. The average cost of providing that support in Iowa varies. If you are receiving Medicaid benefits, which is the low-income benefit that older adults can receive if they meet income guidelines and health guidelines, averages around $40,000 a year. An individual who is paying privately would typically pay $55,000 to $60,000 a year to live in a nursing home. Another type of care is what's called assisted living, which is actually quite a growing industry in Iowa. Interestingly enough, we're expected to see more assisted living beds than we are nursing home beds in the next 5 years in Iowa.
Created or existing?
Existing total. Mm-hmm. Typically, you're going to pay between $40,000 to $45,000 a year for assisted living services. Assisted living services, you do not get the same level of care that you would at a nursing facility. Typically, this individual has needs that may have some mild memory loss. Individual will need some assistance with bathing or dressing or meal preparation. And then there's adult day services. Adult day services is equivalent to a structured but highly skilled environment that supports individuals who may not be safe at home during the day alone, or caregivers may need respite services.
Mm-hmm.
Typically averages $51 a day, which it works out to be around $16,000 a year, if my math does right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have home health services. But the home health services that were referenced in the study really focus on more skilled services. Individuals who typically remain in the home need an array of services that do not include what we call home health services.
Let's talk a little bit, if we could, about the main considerations that people should look at when determining the appropriate level of care for a loved one. What questions should you ask if you're the person affected?
It's very, very challenging, and this is part of what we do at the Heritage Area Agency on Aging, along with our partners across the state, is help individuals provide options for care, what we call across the care continuum, throughout that life process. And making a determination about what sort of services or supports are needed for an individual is unique to each situation. And based on that information, it's frankly a different answer for each individual what best suits their needs at that time. Right now, Iowa, unfortunately, is very, very reliant on what's called institutional-based care or care in nursing facilities. We have more nursing home beds per 1,000 people over the age of 65 than any other state in the country.
And we're one of the oldest states in the country.
And we are one of the oldest states in the country.
Yep.
However, study after study has shown that with appropriate community supports, many of these individuals will be able to live appropriately and safely in a community setting with the use of what's called home and community-based services, which are things like home-delivered meals, respite services, chore services, assistance with bathing and dressing.
How did we get to that point with so much nursing home care here? Have our attitudes towards nursing home changed, nursing homes changed over recent decades?
Well, I think culturally, for years and even nationally, the culture has been institutional care is the appropriate place for individuals. Even our public programs, I'll use Medicaid, is inherently institutional biased. I'll give you the cleanest example is that right now, if you meet certain income guidelines and certain health care needs, you are guaranteed service in a nursing facility.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you would like to receive supports at your home utilizing home and community-based services, the states need to actually ask for what's called a waiver, an allowance to be able to use those state Medicaid and federal dollars to help individuals stay in their home and live independently in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, our public policies are biased to actually supporting individuals and institutions. In addition, most individuals within 5 or 6 months actually deplete their private resources and end up utilizing Medicaid supports.
Do you see this bias changing?
We are certainly hopeful, of course, in the Home and Community-Based Service Network. We are very proud and very happy that Iowa has a contingency of exceptional nursing facilities, and in no way are we suggesting that there is not a need for nursing facilities, but rather we are suggesting that there needs to be a balance of supports available in the community, an opportunity for individuals to choose their place of living when appropriate for them.
Let's just say someone in my family needs a care facility. What are the main questions I would want to ask of a nursing home administrator?
Well, I think the key things that you want to talk to them about is actually how they operate their programs in relationship. Are they met what I would call a medical model, a social model? What sort of staffing patterns do they have? You can actually go online to the Department of Inspections and Appeals website and look for any sort of complaints or concerns that have been founded in relationship to their facilities. And more than actually asking folks, I would actually go to the facility and visit them without an appointment. Go to the facility and say, I'd like to take a look around and talk to the folks.
Without an appointment? Why?
Without an appointment. Because you, first of all, if you're going to entrust this individual and these individuals, rather, with the care of your loved one, you need to feel comfortable that you can go there at any time and actually see the culture and the living of that facility as it is day to day. Now, before you even ask, what would you look in a nursing facility, my first question would be, why do you think this individual needs to live in a nursing facility?
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's assisted living or home care.
Or home care, yeah. Mm-hmm. And in assisted living, again, you need to look very carefully at this industry because, first of all, there's very few affordable assisted living options. So normal people like you and I, probably won't be finding our way there anytime soon, at least not for an extended period of time. But also, it really, depending on that individual's needs, if well coordinated and well supported, that individual can receive supports consistently long term in the community. The programs that we help coordinate at Heritage, we consistently see individuals who qualify for nursing home level of care under something called the elderly waiver live independently in their homes for 2 to 3, even 4 years longer than they would if they were not receiving supports utilizing home and community-based services. So I ask everyone to consider, before you look at placement at a nursing home, consider your options.
Ingrid Wenzel, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today.
Well, I thank you.
Ingrid Wenzel is the Assistant Director of the Heritage Area Agency on Aging in Cedar Rapids. Coming up next, I talk with author Gail Sheehy. Her new book, Passages in Caregiving, details the emotional journey of caring for her husband after his diagnosis with cancer. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio.
And we continue with the exchange from Iowa Public Radio News over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this hour, we're looking at how baby boomers are coping with care of parents. The most recent survey by AARP says that 65 million American adults are trying to take care of a sick parent or in-law or supporting a spouse through chronic illness or a child through disabilities. Author Gail Sheehy has chronicled every major turning point for baby boomers, from politics to sexuality. She's always urging those of us in midlife to prepare for an exhilarating second adulthood. Find your passion and revive old dreams, she proclaims. Then, she says, you get the call that interrupts your life. Your mom's had a bad fall. Your dad's driven through a red light and had an accident. Your spouse calls about a devastating diagnosis. The call plunges most of us into shock and denial. I had 9 months to prepare for the birth of my child, writes Sheehy. I had 9 hours to prepare for taking care of my husband. Gail Sheehy is the author of 15 books, including Passages. It's a book that remained on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. Her latest book is titled Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Gail Sheehy joins us by phone for the remainder of the hour. Good afternoon.
Hi, Ben.
Happy to hear with you.
Great to have you with us. I want to mention that you, Gail, will talk about your new book at the Cheslow Auditorium on the cramped campus of Drake University in Des Moines next Wednesday, May 19th at 7 p.m. We'll look forward to welcoming you to Iowa at that point. Why did you write this book, Gail?
I had to try to reach out to other caregivers and give them a path, because when you're thrown into this role, usually not prepared, certainly you didn't sign up for it, it's chaos, and we aren't really very well prepared to deal with chaos. So when I, after I'd been through this for some of the 17 years off and on that I went through the caregiving journey with my husband, I began to understand that this was more like a labyrinth than like stages of adult development, which I'd written about before. And by a labyrinth, I mean you go around in circles, but there is a path. There is a path, as there is in a labyrinth, that leads you to the center and then helps you to come back out. And I wanted to find the universal turning points along that path, mark them so that future caregivers would have some kind of a map.
I'd like to get to those turning points in just a moment. But first of all, you want to mention you interviewed hundreds of caregivers in all different situations for this book. What is a situation, an example of one that you found most shocking when you interviewed people?
Well, what usually happens is one person, the sort of heroic sibling among the group, takes it all on by herself, and it's usually a woman, because she says, well, this is just what we do. Doesn't see herself as a caregiver, as playing really a very professional role. This is a woman in a middle-class family in Philadelphia, Harriet. She'd been a very promising artist, had gone to art school, but when mom lost dad and, you know, began to fall into geriatric depression, although no one diagnosed it, Harriet just, you know, worked night and day, taking care of her mom at home so as not to send her to a nursing home. But she, Harriet, also worked as a medical claims adjuster 50 to 60 hours a week. So she'd stagger out at 7 o'clock in the morning, try to go to job and keep her income coming. Well, she got sick after a year and a half, as anybody would. And her sister tried to leave her job with IBM and help with mom during the day, but she couldn't make conference calls with mom. Talking in the background, mom had Parkinson's disease and was beginning to have cognitive decline. So finally, the two sisters sent out an email to the rest of the family, and they had altogether six siblings, and said, we can't do this anymore. That's where almost every caregiver gets, but usually they don't make a hotline call or send an email until 3 years.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the universal turns that you describe in the book. You call it playing God, this unhealthy codependent relationship.
Right.
Now, why does it take so long for one of, in this case, many siblings to reach out while it seems the others turn a blind eye?
Well, it's partly because one sibling usually, you know, takes up the responsibility and doesn't ask soon enough, and everybody else gets used to it. And then everybody else has an excuse. I have children. You don't. I live farther away. My job is too demanding. I travel all the time, you know. But that doesn't mean that siblings can't help. You know, one of the things that I can say from having interviewed so many is the farther away your siblings live, the more certain they will be to call and tell you you don't know what you're doing. which is pretty frustrating for the person who's the primary caregiver. So what I recommend is that you have the conversation with your siblings and other family members before the crisis with mom or dad or with your sibling and talk about, you know, mom is getting a little bit forgetful. Dad really probably shouldn't be driving anymore. I just had a white-knuckle drive with him, but he will not give up the car keys. What can we do to start helping mom and dad stay independent longer? And what can we, you know, what do you do best? What can you contribute? Mm-hmm. Some people have, you know, are very good at negotiating. Other people are very good with contracts and can look up the insurance and they'll fine print. Some people are very good at hands-on care. Some people can, you know, be very tough with Medicare and insist upon your rights. And if everybody feels like they have a stake from the beginning, and is being acknowledged for what they can bring to the table, you'll be so much better off when you actually get the call. Because when you get the call about, you know, mom has had a fall and is paralyzed, or dad has had an accident and he doesn't really remember how it happened, you have to jump in to this foreign territory called our fractured healthcare system and begin to deal right away in a language you don't know.
Mm-hmm. I guess then, is there any solution for the sibling who is joyfully, blissfully in denial about a caregiving crisis about to happen?
Well, one of the new ideas is if you set up a shared family calendar and everybody is asked to put in what day or evening they might be available, either to do phone consultations with doctors or to actually come to the house, take care of taking mom or dad to the doctor, and one sibling isn't present, there's a certain amount of pressure, a little guilt pressure there, and they may be able to see their way clearly, contribute some money or, you know, contribute some service.
Gail Sheehy is my guest if you've just joined us for the rest of the hour. Her new book is Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. She'll be speaking about her book at Cheslow Auditorium on the campus of Drake University in Des Moines next Wednesday, May 19th at 7 p.m. Exchange listeners, are you facing a caregiving crisis? What can you tell us? Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Well, you mentioned our healthcare system failing us. In what ways is our present healthcare system failing us when it comes to those serving those in later life? What did you discover in all of this research, Gail?
Well, the traumatic transitions from hospital to rehab and then rehab to subacute rehab and subacute rehab to home. And then when you get a loved one home, there after a first few weeks that may be covered by Medicare if your loved one is old enough, where they'll send an aide, two or three aides to deal with physical therapy and speech therapy, then you're on your own. And so suddenly, a person who has been cared for in a hospital by, you know, 24 different people over the course of 24 hours, all the different specialists, it's now all on you. And you, the caregiver, may very well have a job. You know, today most women work and well into their 50s and 60s, if not 70s. So that free labor pool isn't there anymore. And then the husband can't work and the brother-in-law can't give up work. So who's going to take care or watch out for or supervise the home health care aides who might come in? That's where we have really failed to pony up to the situation that, as you say, 65 million family caregivers who are unpaid face, or if it's just people taking care of adults who used to be independent, it's 50 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost as many people as take care of children under the age of 18.
In your book, though, you also give us some helpful tips about Medicare, tips that are perhaps not widely known for certain situations about how you can use Medicare to help with home care, right?
Right. Well, if your loved one is on Medicaid, you can try to apply for the PACE program, P-A-C-E, which is a Medicaid waiver program where you may be able to bring your family member to a central location where they can be seen by all their doctors and a social worker, and also have social stimulation with other people, and even be possibly picked up, dressed, bathed, and taken to the center two or three times a week. That's a great program. There are many volunteer programs and area agencies on aging in every city, and often in counties or even in towns, that is your should be your first stop. You just call Area Agency on Aging, put in your zip code, and you'll be taken to the closest one, and ask them, what are the community resources?
Mm-hmm.
Who can help me?
In fact, we had a co-director of one of the Area Agencies on Aging in our first half hour, and she said that our system is really biased in favor of nursing homes.
That's true.
And when home care, in many cases, is better and less expensive. You agree with that?
I do, and not only less expensive, but it is so much healthier emotionally and physically and for the family, because I learned in my own case when finally I couldn't take my husband to the hospital or ER anymore because he had chronic pneumonia, which is often where people get to after they've had a lot of other treatment for serious illness. So he's home, but you know, I can't be home all the time to take care of him because I have to continue working to provide for myself in the future. I found palliative care. In New York, we have a very progressive palliative care where they will send a team to work with you at home in order to make sure the patient can stay home and little emergencies or even big ones can be handled right there. With a nurse who is connected to a doctor, she can call and he mm-hmm. will make a house call if it's necessary. This kind of formulation is something most people don't know about. But what often happens is the person gets better once they've been home for a couple of months and is maybe able to actually fight off another infection without going to an emergency room or having special treatment or injections or anything else.
What did you discover about how palliative care can change the way we view the end of life, generally speaking?
Enormous change. Rather than you, the family, accepting what medicine has to give you and is going to, you know, dictate, palliative care puts the power back in the hands of the patient. What are the patient's goals for this time of life, which may last for years, even decades in the case of autoimmune diseases or cognitive decline? Once you know what the patient really values, then you know what kind of treatment to offer. And the patient has to decide in connection with the physician and the caregiver.
Mm-hmm. If that end-of-life conversation presents itself, the person in question is glad to talk about it, that's fine. But what if it's hard to get into that end-of-life conversation? Any advice there?
It's just you just have to keep asking, keep introducing it. What is it that makes you – why do you want to go on – day after day? What is it that brings you joy? What is it that brings you meaning? And if you just get any clues, maybe it's going out to concerts. Maybe it's having a book read to you. Maybe it's, you know, working on your website and still staying in touch with students or colleagues. It could be any number of things, but that to get to that is really important, because when somebody goes into passivity and just kind of begins to withdraw from life, then it becomes much harder for everybody, because you're kind of hanging on to somebody who isn't really sure they want to hang on. And, of course, that's the toughest decision of all, is when to let go.
You said you agreed that it would be better if more elderly were taken care of in the home setting rather than the nursing homes, maybe assisted living. How do we, if we have this institutional bias in favor of those, how do we get from where we are now to what you see as a financially healthier and a overall healthier way of looking after those in the later stage of life?
We have to change the reimbursement system. Right now, the reimbursement system with Medicaid will provide money to take care of an old elderly person in a nursing home, but not at home. Now, why? Couldn't they be taken care of at home? And couldn't a family caregiver who has demonstrated their competency be compensated for giving that time? Why not? It's the nursing home lobby has been able to, you know, co-opt the government and be the recipient of the cash for taking care of people who don't have a lot of money and need some place to be taken care of. We also need to be able to support more geriatricians, because geriatricians become the palliative care doctors who lead the team that can help take care of a loved one at home in what I call the in-between stage. The in-between, when you can't be cured in the hospital anymore because you have chronic problems, and you're a long way from hospice. You don't want to sign on to a six-month deadline with no medication. That's the big period that everybody is ignoring, and where families are, you know, at their wits' end on what to do.
Gail Sheehy is my guest. She'll be with us for the next 5 minutes or so until the end of the hour. Passages in Caregiving, her latest book, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Gail, you had to be, I'm imagining you wrote this, were writing this book during the midst, in the midst of our wonderful health care debate with its talk of death panels and pulling the plug on granny. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that was towards the very end, but boy, was that a shock. The idea that giving families information about the choices they have when they're taking care of an older person, and that somehow, you know, equates with pulling the plug on granny, was such a distortion, so cruel, so terribly destructive in our society. In fact, people don't know what end-of-life options they have. Many people think that Medicare will provide you with help for long-term care. It's not true. And during the whole healthcare debate, the whole issue of long-term care and elder care was taken off the table because it was equated with end-of-life.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you that most illnesses now turn into chronic illnesses, whether it's cancer, heart disease, diabetes, autoimmune, cognitive disabilities, and they can go on for decades. It's what do we do during that period to help families take care of an older person, or it may not even be an older person. It may be somebody with MS who started in 30 at 40.
Even though the health care reform does not include that, as you said, it was taken off the table, end-of-life issues, counseling. Did that debate that was certainly in the press in whatever form it was bring us any closer to understanding, reforming, revising our view of care for the elderly and end-of-life issues, in your opinion?
I think more than anything, it just freaked people out, and, you know, and they became even more disinclined to want to go there. But I will say there is one glimmer of hope in the healthcare law, which is the first government-sponsored long-term healthcare insurance. By the end of this year, employers will be able to offer to employees to have a certain portion of their salary taken out each month to put into a pool for long-term care insurance if and when they need it. The younger they are, the lower the fee and the length of service. If they're older, they'll pay a little bit more. But it begins to form a really huge pool, like Social Security, that could be there for people when they suddenly have a diagnosis that's life-threatening and they have to give up their job. And they would be able to apply for $75 a day, which they could use to pay a family member to help them, or an aide, or retrofit their home.
And is this one of the tips that you give in your book on how a spouse can avoid being stripped of assets to pay for a long-term care of a husband or wife?
Well, I didn't put it in the book because it hadn't actually happened yet. And it's the CLASS Act that Senator Kennedy had been trying to get passed for almost 30 years. But also, it's not going to come into effect, you know, for about 6 years. These healthcare, long-term healthcare plans through the government have to vest for at least 5 years. So there's no point in giving it as a false promise to people now.
Mm-hmm.
What we need now is to have some reimbursement system available for people who give up their jobs to do this professional level job of being the, you know, hands-on caregiver of an elderly person, keeping them out of the nursing home, and offering something that is much cheaper than taxpayers paying for others in nursing homes.
Do you have any hope that there is the political will at some point to do that change?
I think it only happens when, you know, that tip-over point occurs with baby boomers. Enough of them themselves in their mid to late 60s need help and don't want to burden their children, their adult children. Many are divorced, living alone. So who's going to take care of these folks? If it has to be the sibling who has to give up his or her job when they're at the peak of their career in their 50s, we're going to lose two for every one. We can't afford that as a society. Already, the estimate of the actual value, financial value of free caregiving is up to almost $400 billion a year.
Gail Sheehy, thank you for joining us this half hour. Thank you for joining us to talk about your new book, Passages in Caregiving.
Thank you, Ben.
Passages in Caregiving, the latest book by Gail Sheehy. She joined us live by phone, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Once again, we'll mention that Gail Sheehy will be in Iowa next week to talk about her new book at Cheslow Auditorium on the campus of Drake University in Des Moines next Wednesday, May 19th at 7 p.m. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Our producer assistant today, Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Just a reminder that on Monday, on this hour, last month, scientists announced the discovery of a new hominid species that lived almost 2 million years ago. Monday, conversation with Lee Berger, the American paleoanthropologist who made the find, along with his 12-year-old son. And then Iowa State University paleoanthropologist Kayla Follansbee will be joining us, and University of Iowa paleontologist Robert Franciscus. Join us on Monday when we return with The Exchange as we explore human origins. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.